For those of you that were here last week, any kind of big thoughts, any lingering, it's a risky question, isn't it? Anything that stuck from last week? Anyone want to say, yeah, you know, this stood out last time? We'll just do a little bit of a review.
Ordinary people.
Yeah, the ordinary people. Meaning, so what?
Well, you think of the biblical characters being some great, they're just ordinary
people, yeah.
Living their lives in an ordinary life.
Right. Ordinary just like us.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks, Tim. Yeah. It's funny, isn't it? You got the title of the book, Ruth. You're tuned to think this is about Ruth, but actually the focus was really Naomi. And what stood out about Naomi's experience? Yeah, she suffered. Any comments on that? Yeah. So we're going to come back to that tonight, because it wasn't for her sin. It wasn't primarily for her character. It wasn't to keep her humble. It was something else. God's doing something else in the book of Ruth. And that's something that's helpful for us to remember, that sometimes we go through something and it isn't sort of a tit for tat thing. It could be that we are part of a bigger picture. And when we see the bigger picture, we may be thrilled, even though when we're in it, we may really struggle with the challenges that come. And Naomi was a devastated woman, wasn't she? Remember how the story began? Her husband, anyone remember his name? Elimelech, which means, right, so my God is king, married to Naomi, which means pleasant, lovely couple, right? My God is king and pleasant, leave Bethlehem, which means house of bread, because of a famine. Yeah. Bit strange. So there's this famine, God is obviously disciplining. This is the time of the judges, all right? So it's a really difficult era in the history of God's people. And it's essentially a history of God bringing discipline after discipline, and then a deliverer in the context of each of those disciplines. So it was a tough time, and there's this famine, and my God is king, bailed out. All right, he left, for whatever his thinking was, he left the house of bread, with all the irony involved in that. And where did they go? They went to Moab. Now, we kind of hear Moab and go, oh, Moab. Doesn't, you know, do much for us. But for them, for a Jew to go to Moab really is like going to the worst of the worst. It's sort of the ultimate enemies. They had been despisers, if that's the right term, of God's people right the way through, ever since the beginning. And the Jews and the Moabites had all sorts of tension between them. But they go to the fields of Moab, and they're going to survive and eat there while there's a famine back home. Except tragedy strikes. And in the course of, what is it, a couple of verses at the start, by verse 5, Naomi's whole world has just collapsed. Her husband has died, and then her two sons have died. Now, that means not only does she have the grief of losing her life partner, she also has the grief of losing her two sons, and that's not the order it's supposed to happen in. Parents are supposed to die first, and the tragedy of losing a child is profound and unique, and she's gone through all of that, and she's left with two major problems. Anyone remember what the major issues are for Naomi? Yeah, no descendants. So this whole family line that had gone on for generation after generation had hit a brick wall with her, because her descendants had died, and now she's old, and in the chapter she's telling her daughters-in-law, I'm not having any more children, even if I did, you know. So it's a situation where the sort of the big historical picture is, I'm the end of the road, I'm the end of the line. So the issue of line is a big one. And then what was the other one? A more immediate, pressing need. Yeah, no one to provide, no food. How are we going to eat today? And that's the first issue. We're going to look at that a little bit in the chapter tonight. And then the issue of the line, the descendants, the impossible. Should we call it that? The impossible we're going to see more of next time. Okay, so that was chapter 1. Now, what was the big lesson in terms of Naomi? Here's this woman that's utterly devastated And she uses language of bitterness and the kind of language you would use if you went through those same experiences. And yet, remember what we saw last week, that she leaned towards God. She probably didn't have the strength to make it through the day, but she leaned towards God and made it back to Bethlehem. And there she comes, and she never blames her husband, she never blames circumstances, never blames the devil. She says, God is doing all of this. She's got a view of God that I think is quite impressive, even though she seems to be deeply, deeply struggling. And then right at the end, we saw how she referred to God twice as, what does it say in English? The Almighty and Lord, all capitals. Anyone remember what the word Almighty is? We sing a song sometimes, El Shaddai, the Almighty. He is able, he is capable, he can do what he wants. But what does he want? What does Lord mean? The word Lord, the name, the personal name of God, Yahweh, which speaks of what? If the first one is he's able, then Yahweh is what? He is faithful. He's a God who makes promises and keeps them, a God who doesn't let his people go. And so the able, faithful God of Israel is the God of Naomi. And along the way, just as a so almost as an aside, we meet Ruth, this wonderful daughter-in-law who's been widowed and yet doesn't go back to her own people and the comforts and the security and the provision of her own father's house and all of that, or another husband. She clings on to Naomi. Remember the contrast, the foil in the story to Ruth is, who? What's her name? Orpah. I'm just making sure no one said Oprah. So Orpah, she's the one that initially she's hanging on a little bit, but a little bit of pushing and she goes. And there's that sad comment that she's gone back to her gods. And so there's Orpah going back to her gods, but Ruth makes that speech that is worthy of being framed somewhere, doesn't it? You know, your people will be my people. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Where you die, I will die. You know, your God, my God. And she goes through all these things, and may God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything parts me from you. And you find yourself kind of almost welling up. The commitment of that woman to her mother-in-law. And I suggested that over the years, she had to get that faith in the Lord, the God of Israel, from someone. And my guess is she got it from Naomi. And now she's not letting that God or that mother-in-law go. And she joins her and they come back to Bethlehem. Remember how the chapter ended? Final little phrase at the end. The beginning of the harvest. Now, let's look at chapter 2. And what we're going to do is slightly different to last week. I'm going to read it through. And anybody need a pen? We have some pens available. You put your hand in the air. Then, Hannah, can you grab the pens over here and distribute them to the hands that are up? And I'll just explain how we're going to do this as the pens are coming around. I'm going to read it through. Fairly steady pace, not in a real rush. And I'll read it through. And as we go, just feel free to mark anything that jumps out at you for any reason. You might want to look for any way that God is at work. Anything that sort of points to God being at work behind the scenes there. I think we've got a different version, Colin, so it might be better to... Yeah. Notice any new characters. There's a big one coming. You don't want to miss him. Verse 1. All right, so any characters. But don't feel pressure to write. It's just there so you can scribble and take notes if you want to. And then as we go through it again after the hymn, then we'll have time to interact a little bit about the text, and I'll make sure that you do notice a few things and mark a few things along the way. Okay, so just let the pens get to the last couple here, and then I'll read our way through Ruth chapter 2. Okay. It's not too late. Hand in the air. There you go. Right. Ruth 2. Now, Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth, the Moabite, said to Naomi, Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor. And she said to her, go, my daughter. So she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem. And he said to the reapers, the Lord be with you. And they answered, the Lord bless you. Then Boaz said to his young man who was in charge of the reapers, whose young woman is this? And the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered, she is the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. She said, please let me glean and gather among the sheaves after the reapers. So she came, and she has continued from early morning until now, except for a short rest. Then Boaz said to Ruth, now listen, my daughter, do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping, and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn. Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner? But Boaz answered her, all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward will be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. Then she said, I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, though I am not one of your servants. And at mealtime, Boaz said to her, come here and eat some bread and dip your morsel in the wine. So she sat beside the reapers, and he passed to her roasted grain. And she ate until she was satisfied, and she had some left over. When she rose to glean, Boaz instructed his young men, saying, let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not reproach her. And also, pull out some from the bundles for her, and leave it for her to glean. Do not rebuke her. So she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. And she took it up and went into the city. Her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. She also brought out and gave her what food she had left over after being satisfied. And her mother-in-law said to her, where did you glean today? And where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you. So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, the man's name with whom I worked today is Boaz. And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, may he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. Naomi also said to her, the man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers. And Ruth the Moabite said, besides, he said to me, you shall keep close by my young men until they finished all my harvest. And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, it is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young women, lest in another field you be assaulted. So she kept close to the young women of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and wheat harvests, and she lived with her mother-in-law. Well, we had a feast at lunch today. I'm sure there was quite a lot of food left over, which is kind of normal, isn't it, at church gatherings like that. And I wonder if sometimes we take that a little bit for granted. This issue that Naomi had of enough food for the day is an issue that faces a massive number of people in the world. I don't think most of us have experienced that, have we? We live in a relative level of luxury. But did you know that today, as we're sitting here, one in seven people on this planet are hungry? One in seven will go to bed tonight without having had enough to eat. That's a real significant number, isn't it? 1 billion people living on not enough. I remember some years ago I was in, I think it was the Dominican Republic, and I was speaking in this church in the middle of, felt like the jungle, it was the middle of who knows where, and my translator, Roger, and I were taken by the pastor back to the ship afterwards where we were working, but on the way he said, I want to bring you to my home, you need to meet my family. And we said, that's wonderful, thank you. So we went to their home, little tin hut in the middle of this kind of tin hut village, and they said, we've made some food, and I wasn't hungry, but you sit down and you eat what you're given, and we sat down and we ate this food, and the whole family stood around. Nobody else sat down, it was just me and Roger sitting, and the whole family and the pastor and some neighbor's kids and some neighbor's kids' friends, you know, everybody was watching, probably me, the most white man, you know, they were watching as we ate. And I had this distinct sense that they have given us probably everything they've got. And I'm sitting there thinking, I don't even need this. I'm going back to a ship where there's food on demand. It's like a buffet on that thing at times, you know. And here I am eating this food, but I had to eat it because it would be offensive not to. It strikes you when you see people that don't have much, that maybe that prayer that Jesus prayed, you remember the Lord's Prayer? Give us this day our daily bread. Give us sufficient bread for today. It strikes me that that is something that we can just kind of skim over because, you know, even if you didn't go shopping, you could probably survive on the tin food in your cupboards for a few weeks, most of us. But give us today our daily bread. Almost as if we've got more than enough for today, then we probably should be looking for someone to give the excess to. Because for 1 billion people in the world today, that's a reality, is how am I going to have enough food for today? And that was the reality that Naomi was facing. And I suppose it's tempting to sort of skim over chapter 2, because chapter 2 deals with the food issue, and kind of get to the exciting stuff in 3, but it just struck me as I was looking at this, maybe we just need to slow down and realize how privileged we are. Maybe we need to stop and pray before we eat and let it be more heartfelt. I know for me growing up, in our family, for some reason, we always prayed the same prayer. For what we're about to receive, may the Lord make us truly thankful. It struck me after some years that actually, that's not even a prayer. For what we're about to receive, may the Lord make us truly thankful. Who are we talking to? I mean, it was this, but it was just part of the routine almost, and it felt very routine for me. But actually, when you realize what a privilege it is to have food for your stomach, you stop and you say, Lord, thank you so much for this. Speaking at the other end of the scale, we were just in America for a few weeks, and they've got some food there. And I remember stopping at this burger place. I won't make you too jealous, but it was good. And I needed to get something for lunch, and, you know, what are you going to do? Go to McDonald's when you've got, like, Culver's, as it was, the best option around? So I went through the drive-thru and got this burger, and I remember sitting in the car. I still had the engine running, you know, sorry, but I needed the air conditioning. It was a bit hot out. And I was sitting in the car, and I opened this burger, and just the smell, I said, oh, Lord, thank you so much for this. This is beautiful after eating burgers in England for a while. And so, you know, there's something about the heartfelt thank you that I think is appropriate. And maybe I'll admit I'm not one that's heartfelt enough, despite being married to a great cook. Now, let's look at this passage, because this is God's provision for Naomi. And part of my hope is that as we read through Ruth with ordinary people in a culture just like ours, with a God doing just about as much miraculous stuff as we tend to see, i.e. none, God working behind the scenes, it's my prayer, my hope over these weeks that we will get eyes to see, that we will develop an awareness of God being at work in our lives, because he is. Even if it's not parting the Red Sea and doing stunning things like that. So let's look at this then. We'll take it one scene or even a paragraph at a time. But there's 5 scenes. This story, this chapter, is going to move from Ruth and Naomi in their house or wherever they're staying. It might have been a cave or something. But wherever they're staying, it's Ruth and Naomi. And then Ruth in the field in the morning and then lunch. and then Ruth in the field in the afternoon, and then Ruth and Naomi back at home again. And any time you have a structure like that, where there's some balance between the beginning and the end, it's actually designed to point you towards the middle. And so the focal point of this chapter is going to be lunch. Okay, so I hope you didn't come hungry tonight, because we're just going to talk about food quite a bit. But so let's take the first scene. Here's Naomi and Ruth, first two verses. Anything you want to notice there? Anybody want to say, don't miss this, this is important?
It seems that they knew that they were going to be in the relatives' field. Seems to come as a surprise
again. Yeah, it's sort of telling us, it's the narrator, isn't it, giving us some information that Naomi knew, Ruth didn't. And all through the chapter, Naomi's not doesn't know where Ruth is. I mean, she didn't text home and say, guess whose field I'm in. All right, so this is information that's privileged information for us. And therefore, it's obviously important information, isn't it? And you're right, Colin, to go straight to that. What is it about this man that's significant? What does it tell us about him? Sorry, was that?
A redeemer.
A redeemer, yep. Yeah, so this whole thing of being from the clan or the extended family. Back in the law of Moses, provision was made for just such a time as this, that if a family was hit by some sort of disaster, if tragedy strikes and a husband dies, his widow isn't just hopeless. There's a provision in God's law that a relative, the nearest relative of the husband, it has the right, has the privilege, or even the responsibility of stepping in, both in terms of the land. You don't want the land being sold off to whoever walks down the street. You want to keep that in the family, and also in terms of descendants. And so, remember that question when Jesus was in the temple courts and the Pharisees and the Sadducees were taking turns trying to trip him up. And the Sadducees came along with their trick question. What was it? A woman was married to a husband and he died, and so his brother married her and he died, and you know, she married all seven of them, and then they go to heaven. Whose husband will she be? And Jesus, he gives a brilliant answer, especially if you know what the Sadducees are into. He says, should be, you know, in heaven we'll be like the angels. And they're going, we don't believe in angels. He's like, ha-ha, gotcha. You know, but it'll be like the angels, neither giving in marriage or whatever. You know, it's this trick question, is assuming this kind of background, that somebody isn't left destitute. There are family members who step in and provide care and provision. So as soon as we see that here, he's related to Boaz. Ooh. You see, if we've been swimming in the first five books of the Old Testament, as soon as we see that, the alarm bells go off and we go, oh, this could be good. Let's see where this might lead. Anything else we're told about this man Boaz?
He's worthy.
Yeah, he's a worthy man. And we're told his name, which I don't need to tell you because I'm sure you know, but it means that in him is strength, obviously. I had to look it up, I'm just kidding. Okay, so what else are we told in these first two verses? What does it say about Ruth?
She kind of expects to find favor.
Mm-hmm. Which implies that she knows the law. And maybe she's assuming, coming into the land, that the law's provision for gleaners is still in force. All right, even if this is the time of the judges and terrible things are going on, she knows the law enough to assume that if she goes to a field, there will be food for her to find. Because again, God provided, God cared enough so that in his rules for Israel, he told them, when you're harvesting, don't go up to the edges. He wasn't a big fan of combine harvesters that go right up to the edges, right? He said, just leave some and don't go back over it. Don't recycle through and pick up the bits you've dropped. Let that be for the stranger, the foreigner, the widows, those that need something. Make sure that you don't vacuum the field so they're left with nothing. And so Ruth is expecting that, and she goes out, because really there's not many other options, certainly not moral options that she would want to pursue in order to get any sort of food or provision. And there's one other thing it says about Ruth. Notice the label that comes with her name. The Moabite. At least five times in Ruth, the book, it says Ruth the Moabite. It really is underlining the fact that this woman is a foreigner. We'll come back to that in a minute. So she heads out and she goes to the field. And I don't know if you underlined it or not, but there's some good stuff in verses 3 and 4. You don't want to miss it. Anybody want to point out what happens there? Where does she end up? Yeah, and it seems like it's sort of an accident, doesn't it? And she happened to come. Literally, that's her chance chanced upon. So it really is, in the text as it was written, really kind of, ooh, look at this coincidence. She just happened to come to the field of Boaz. And behold, verse 4, Boaz decides to come that day and to visit one of his fields. And so he comes, and look at the hint here about Boaz's character. Everything you see about Boaz is going to make you like him, I think. All right, unless you don't like nice people. But Boaz, here, verse 4, he arrives. Remember, this is the time of the judges. The Lord be with you. This is a godly man. And their response, the Lord bless you. And this is the kind of man I'd like to work for. Don't you think? He's got a godliness about him, a godly awareness. And then so he asks about Ruth. Don't recognize this one. Who's she? And he's told of her reputation. She's the Moabite. Notice what it says there. The young Moabite woman, verse 6, who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. It's underlining the Moab bit. Doesn't need to say that, but he says it. And she asked, and what does it say about her work ethic? She's continued from early morning until now, except for a short rest. She works hard, is what he's saying. You know her reputation. Let me give you a reputation from this morning. This woman is a hard worker. So then Boaz starts talking to Ruth. All right, still in the fields, perhaps late morning, somewhere like that. Now, what does he say to her? What do you notice about Boaz's instructions to Ruth? Yeah, he's telling her to stay safe. Do you notice anything else in terms of safety? He seems particularly concerned for her safety or even her purity. Any other comments there? Yeah, he's told the young men already, hands off. Right, he knows what, you know, this is not a safe environment. Even if they're saying the Lord bless you, he's already given them instructions. This is not a safe place for someone as vulnerable as a beautiful young foreign lady. And so he's going out of his way to make sure that she's safe. There's other comments in here as well about that. Anything else that he says to her? Yeah, my daughter, that's sort of a polite way to address a younger woman. We don't know what the age difference is here, except the sense is that he's probably much older. All right, so sort of a 20-year gap. So I don't know. We don't know, to be honest. But the sense that you get is that he's an older man. So he refers to her as my daughter. There's nothing in this that's romantic. I don't want to disappoint any of the ladies here who are hoping this will be like one of those films. But at this point, everything that Boaz is saying to her really is a response of respect to the way she's cared for Naomi. Her reputation has preceded her, and he's going out of his way to provide for her, to protect her, to care for her. Any other comments in that paragraph? Refers to the Lord a couple of times in verse 12. The Lord repay you. Interesting, isn't it? The Lord, remember the faithfulness of Yahweh? May Yahweh be faithful to you. It's kind of what he's saying, isn't it? May be faithful to you for what you've done. And a full reward be given to you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. Now, is that prayer going to get answered? Is God going to provide and protect and care for Ruth? Oh, yes. Boaz has no idea how, but that's coming next time. And she's just blown away, isn't she? I found favor in your eyes. You've comforted me. You've spoken kindly to me. I'm not even one of your servants. This is a really positive interaction. Then we come to the meal time, the lunch. Okay, this is the centerpiece of this passage. So let's make sure we notice what's going on there. What do you see there that grabs your attention?
Well, obviously, given the bread, he's allowing their dividend there, life.
Yeah, right. So he's not saying, "Oi, here's some bread, love," and throwing something to her at a distance. He's inviting her in to eat with the privileged ones, the official workers, the gleaners there, and he's providing bread and letting her dip in the wine. So this is turning into a good meal, roasted grain. I don't know if that doesn't sound that great to me, but I'm sure it is. I'm sure maybe someone wants to roast some grain for us before next Sunday. We'd be glad to share your roasted grain. And then what does it say after that? For a woman who's come from Moab with a very empty stomach, not knowing how they're going to survive day by day, look at what it says. She ate until she was satisfied and she had some left over. Wow. That must have been quite the experience for her. And so Boaz told his young men, "Let her glean even among the sheaves. Don't reproach her. Don't assault her. Don't touch her. Don't humiliate her. Don't do..." I mean, they are getting a talking to, right? He really is going out of his way to make sure that this young lady is cared for. In fact, notice what he says in verse 16. As you're carrying along your big bundles, pull some out. You've already done the work, young men. Pull some out. Let it stay on the ground so that her work is easier. Isn't that gracious? She's walking along trying to find anything they missed, and suddenly she's finding handfuls of barley. And so then we get the afternoon. Verse 17, summarized pretty quickly. She gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. So, forgive me, I'm not a farmer here, but barley is a crop, right? And you pick it, you grab it, whatever. But you've got to separate out the good stuff from the bad stuff. You've got to get the grain out and separate it from the chaff. That's work. And so by evening, she's got all this barley, and now she threshes it, and what's the phrase it uses there? She beat it. All right, so she smacked it around and get the chaff to come off, and what's left is the real treasure. And how much has she got? An ephah of barley. What's an ephah of barley?
38
meters. Interesting. Okay. In buckets. Depends. There's different ephahs. I'm going to be slightly more conservative. Let's give, just be a little bit safer here. I would say 22 liters, but somewhere in there. Okay, so 22 liters. That's two buckets full of barley, or maybe slightly more. What does that weigh? I didn't go to a field and check this out, but I did look it up online. The weight of it. Tim, would you mind coming up here? I've only done one bucket. I didn't do two, but this is the weight. Here, okay. Now Tim's going to be all manly, right? And show us, give us a demonstration of how much that weighs.
That's heavy.
Don't hurt yourself, Tim.
That's heavier than two bucketfuls of water.
That's about 16 kilos. That's hefty, right? You're back, okay?
Yeah.
Good. So she's finished her day's work and she's ended up with at least two buckets full of volume that weighs more than water, in Tim's words. That's a lot, right? For someone who the day before was starving. And she's got that, and she comes home, or back to her mother-in-law. Look at this final paragraph. And her mother-in-law saw. She set eyes on the amount, probably because Ruth is, kind of staggering a bit, carrying it. And she saw it. And then she brings out the leftovers from lunch, the little box you get in a restaurant, and there's the leftovers, and she shares that with her mother-in-law. Notice how it's written now in these verses here. verse 19, it's really slowing down the storytelling. Her mother-in-law said to her, "Where did you glean today? Where have you worked?" That's the same question, but it's slowing us down. Blessed be the man who took notice of you. So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, this is really taking its time, isn't it? The man's name with whom I worked today, drum roll please, Boaz. And at that point, Naomi's jaw just hits the floor. Boaz. Whoa. Now, I don't want to presume to know what's going on in Naomi's mind, okay? God's given me one wife, and it's my privilege to try to figure out what's going on in the much more complex world of my wife's thinking and emotions, right? So I'm not going to even try to figure out any other females. But Naomi here, I think the cogs are turning pretty fast, right? Notice what she says. May he be blessed by the Lord, faithful one. Notice what it says immediately after the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. Now, why is she mentioning the dead? I wonder if she's starting to concoct a scheme. He is a relative of my dead husband. He is a kinsman. He is a redeemer. He is somebody that perhaps there's hope here, not just food, but perhaps there's a line still to come in my husband's family through this kin. Well, I don't know how quickly she got to that, but she gets there pretty soon. There's something certain people do like to matchmake, and I think Naomi's already starting to get the cogs turning there. So she makes it clear the man is a close relative of ours. He's one of our redeemers. Okay, so she's starting to think, oh, maybe, oh, look what God's done. You ended up there. And so the story, the passage ends. Did you notice this detail when we read it? Ruth seems somewhat oblivious. She says, another thing he said, she's just, you know, talking about, another thing he said was stick close to my young men. And she doesn't seem to have any problem with that. Naomi, I think, already has another plan. So verse 21, stick by my young men. Verse 22, Naomi's saying, go with his young women. She doesn't want any of those young men, you know, catching the attention of Ruth. I think she's already got someone else in mind. She's already starting to plot and scheme. And Ruth just takes that and says, okay. And so she kept close to the young women of Boaz. And she gleaned until the end of the barley harvest and then the end of the wheat. Is it wheat harvests? The two spring harvests? No pun intended. And so we've come quite a few weeks. How long would that be? 6-8 weeks of gleaning. That's a lot of provision. And she lived with her mother-in-law. Now, that's a whole lot more upbeat than last week, isn't it? You know, there's matchmaking in the air. There's an awful lot of respect going on both ways between Ruth and Boaz. It's almost as if we're starting to see God's plan being worked out. It's almost as if last week in chapter 1, God was doing something that involved getting this Moabite woman back to Bethlehem. Maybe that was his plan. Maybe that's what needed to happen. I think it certainly was. Now, I think there's two things we need to see here. Firstly, let's not just skim over the fact of provision. When our stomachs rumble, we eat. Let's develop a gratitude for that that perhaps has faded with easy access to food. Let's recognize God's hand involved in providing for our needs. When you eat a snack, when you eat a meal, when it's a home-cooked wonderful meal, or even if it's some fast food, whatever it is, let's pause and not just say a prayer that kind of goes through the routine, but actually genuinely, honestly, from the heart, say, Lord, thank you for this. I'm eating this, and there may be five others eating, but there's another one that's hungry. Because 1 in 7 of the world's population are hungry each night. Now that should make us thankful. It should make us generous. It should give us hearts that are grateful when our stomachs are full and seeing God's hand at work in all of the little things in life. But let's just take a couple of minutes and start to think about this other question. What is God doing? I hinted at it last week. I've seen enough now to say we've got to look at this just for a couple minutes. Why did God allow Naomi to end up in a foreign land, losing her husband and her sons, to be utterly devastated, in order to then come back to her land with this foreign young widow who's godly, who seems to be a delightful person in all sorts of ways, and now she's back in Bethlehem? I mean, God couldn't have done it, I don't think, in many other ways. He could have sent an angel with a plane ticket to Moab and said, Ruth, you need to go to Bethlehem. And she would have said, why? And yet God worked out the details to bring this Moabite foreign woman back to Bethlehem. Let me read you half a verse. In Matthew chapter 1, it's so good I can't wait till chapter 4, it'll be a waste, so we're going to see it early. In Matthew chapter 1, we've got the genealogy of Jesus. Okay? Starts with Abraham, it goes through David, it goes through 42 generations. That's not the interesting thing. The interesting thing is that there are some women in the genealogy. It's not what you'd expect. And in verse 5, second half of the verse, it talks about Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother, giving it away, but whose mother was Ruth. Isn't it beautiful that in the line of the Messiah himself, there's a foreigner? In fact, there's more than one foreigner. It almost makes the point, before you've even got half a paragraph into the New Testament, that God is still the God of all nations, not just the God of one nation, a God of all peoples, a God who would go out of his way to make sure that in the line of his son, there's this girl Ruth. And if he wants to put Ruth in that line, doesn't that give us a sort of a thrill in our hearts that maybe he likes us too, that he wants us to be part of his son's family, his son's bride? If he goes that far out of his way to get Ruth into the genealogy, maybe it says something about God's view of Gentiles like us. But here's a question. Why is Boaz so kind to Ruth? Why? I mean, he seems like a nice man. He's a worthy man. He's a law-abiding man. But why is he sensitive, it seems, to a Gentile? Why is he so concerned about the purity of a Gentile woman? You know what it says in the first half of that verse? Salmon, or Salmon, the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. Isn't that beautiful? Boaz, his whole life, had been sensitized to the plight of a Gentile woman with all sorts of integrity issues who had a courageous love for the people of God. And suddenly he sees a foreign woman whose reputation is a courageous love for the people of God. And so he goes out of his way to protect her purity. Isn't that beautiful? God had prepared Boaz. In the circumstances of his life, God had prepared Ruth in the circumstances of her life. It's almost as if God is at work behind the scenes, sometimes doing things that don't even make sense till generations later. I wonder if that's true in our lives. I wonder if God is doing some things in our lives that we don't understand, that we cannot make sense of. Not just the daily provision. You know, that can be a real big deal when you haven't got it. You pray for that and God provides. That's wonderful. But maybe God's doing something that's long term. Maybe God's doing something that's big. And we haven't got the faintest notion. That doesn't stop him, because he is the Lord. He's faithful. His kindness keeps on going. Whose kindness. You remember that phrase there? Naomi talked about it in verse 20. May he be blessed by Yahweh, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. That word kindness is loving kindness, loyal love, the chesed of God. It's this powerful word in the Old Testament for the grace of God. And Naomi's pointed it out here. It's three times in the book of Ruth. Think of that psalm. Is it 136? For his love endures forever. His love endures forever. 26 times it repeats that line. For his loving kindness endures forever. And here we are in our circumstances, in our life, with who knows what going on. Well, God knows what. He knows what he's doing when things don't seem right from our perspective. He's working things out. And when we see the big picture, when we get to heaven and look back and see how it's all been woven together, we're going to say, oh, his loving kindness endures forever. He never forsook me. He never turned his back on me. He never let me down. Because the Lord is faithful. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for this, just this day in the life that we read in Ruth 2, and yet it points us to profound realities about who you are and how you work. Lord, would you give us the food that we need for each day? Keep us from taking that for granted. Lord, would you provide for us this week? Help us to lean on you and to trust in you. And Lord, as our stomachs are filled, would you give us hearts that are thankful to you? Give us gratitude for the abundance that you provide. And Lord, as you give us hearts that are grateful, would you give us eyes to see how you're working in little ways behind the scenes, sometimes imperceptibly, but sometimes we catch a glimpse of your hand at work. Help us to spot that this week. Give us a sensitivity to see you working. And Lord, for the big picture, the big plan, the big things that you're doing that we can't even begin to imagine, would you just give us trust? Just that sense that your history, your track record stands, and it stands firm. And in light of everything that you've done down through those years, everything you've done down through our years, would you give us a trust in you that we would lean in your direction, and that even when we don't know what's going on, that we would know who is working it all out, and that we would just trust you in a way that would be pleasing to you. Because, Lord, when we catch a glimpse of how you work, you are so pleasing to us. And so give us this week stomachs that are satisfied. Give us hearts that are thankful. Give us eyes to see. And give us lives that speak out our trust in you. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.